is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran censures the UN for refusing to blacklist Israel and the Saudi coalition over their crimes against Palestinian and Yemeni children. Syrian media report that a U.S. military base in eastern Syria's Al Umar oil field has been targeted with missiles. Also coming up, Ethiopia's federal government declares a unilateral ceasefire in its war-torn Tigray region as rebels take control of the regional capital, Mekelle. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has criticized the world body for excluding Israel and the Saudi-led coalition from its list of violators of children's rights. Majid Takhtarvanchi said the most systematic and gross violation of the rights of children in West Asia continues by the Israeli regime. He cited UN data that showed over 1,000 cases of Israeli violations against 340 Palestinian children. Takhtarvanchi also said over 3,500 children have been killed in the Saudi-led war on Yemen, as stated by a UN report. The UN Secretary-General added Yemen's Ansar Allah movement to the blacklist, citing an alleged use of child soldiers. Yemen, however, has vehemently rejected the accusation. Jafar Amini is a Palestinian writer and political commentator joining us out of Perth. Jafar, welcome. Were you surprised when you saw that Israel and the Saudi Arabia were not included in the United Nations blacklist of child violators?
Not at all. I mean, if nobody should look for any justice or any humanity from the UN. The UN was created as a tool for Western powers to show that they are democratic and they have human values. Nothing of the sort. While you have America in there exercising the right of veto, nothing tangible or nothing human will happen. Israel is protected. They are the favorite child of the United States of America, and so is Saudi Arabia. And there is this sacred cow called the West's interest that should be protected at any cost. And if you look at the social media, there is every day at least a dozen pictures of Palestinian children of the age of 7, 8, and 9, and sometimes even 5, are dragged brutally by the Israeli occupation forces, put in prison, not allowed access by their parents or legal representation, and terrified out of their wits simply for being Palestinians or tossing a pebble or a stone on an armored personnel carrier. No, the United Nations is not there to help the weak and the maligned and the oppressed. It's there to protect the interests of the powerful nations like America, Britain, France, right, and Western countries.
I mean, Jafar, some would say it's astonishing what you're saying, that Israel or Saudi Arabia is not on the blacklist, but how does the UN Secretary General look when his own data from the United Nations is acknowledging, as the Iran's ambassador noted, that Israel has violated Palestinian children? 1,000 cases that have been documented by the UN itself. and 3,500 children by Saudi have been killed by the Saudi Arabia. The figures are obviously more, according to many other researchers and monitoring groups. But this is the United Nations that is acknowledging this.
Well, look, in answer to your question, he looks like a fool, and he is not there to do what he thinks is right. He is there to do what he's told to do. And as far as Israel and Saudi Arabia, they are the untouchables as far as America is concerned. Israel for the obvious reasons, and Saudi Arabia for the oil and the huge contracts that the Saudi government affords to American companies every year, and of course the bases that are there for America to control the area from Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and Qatar and here and there. We live in a warped world, my friend, and the meek, I'm afraid, shall not inherit the earth. This is about brute power and interest. If I may just add another dimension to this, I mean, look at the raids that the United States of America has inflicted on Syria and Iraq 2 days ago. And they termed it as self-defense. I mean, they are borrowing from the textbook of their favorite child,
right.
Israel.
Yeah. Just because we're running out of time, just one final question, Jaffa, which I have raised with another analyst. I just want to get your opinion on it. Saudi Arabia was on this blacklist until 2 years ago, and then it was delisted. And the former UN chief, Ban Ki-moon, at least he had the courage to say that the Saudi Arabia and or its allies had put pressure on me or on the United Nations that it would take away its funding for UN programs, and therefore you have to, you know, take us out of the blacklist. We don't hear such words from the current Secretary General of the United Nations. Do you think that's the case as well with regards to Saudi Arabia and Israel? That they're threatening?
Of course. I mean, and America as well. I mean, it's about funding. And America, to my certain knowledge, owes at the moment over $800 million to the UN in unpaid funds. And if you starve somebody of funds, you dictate the terms, and that's what they're doing. And I'd like to go back to the raid on Syria and Iraq 2 days ago, and America call it self-defense. I mean, how do you attack a sovereign state 4,000 miles away from your land and call it self-defense? It's aggression. They're doing what they're doing because to please Israel. And the irony of it all, they're attacking Iran and Iran's interests while they're talking to Iran about the nuclear deal. This is the hypocrisy of the extreme.
Jaffa, thank you very much indeed for your contribution there. Jaffa Amini is a Palestinian writer and political commentator joining us out of Perth, Australia. Now, Iran has marked the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party by the US-backed Mujahideen-e-Khalq terror organization known as the MKO. The occasion is marked every year as part of week-long ceremonies dubbed the American Human Rights Week. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Rights activists, along with families of terror victims in Iran, attended this gathering in Tehran to mark the American Human Rights Week. The annual occasion aims to shed light on the U.S.'s record of rights violations in Iran.
We're marking the American Human Rights Week to review the numerous cases where the U.S. openly violated human rights in our country, like the American Navy's downing of our passenger plane in 1988, after which the perpetrators received a badge of honor in the U.S. The latest crime the U.S. has committed was to assassinate the spearhead of the fight against terrorism, General Qasem Soleimani.
The second day of the week-long occasion marks the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party in Tehran by the U.S.-backed Mujahideen-e-Khalq terror organization, known as the MKO. 73 leading officials of the Islamic Republic were killed, including former Justice Chief Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Beheshti. Iran says it has lost over 17,000 people in terrorist attacks. 12,000 of them were killed at the hands of the formidable MKO terrorist group. What's even more shocking is that the U.S. does not regard the MKO as a terrorist entity and has even established intimate ties with them.
The U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist organization. Following this measure, the group was relocated from its former stronghold at a U.S. military base in Iraq to Albania and France. Ever since, the MKO has held regular meetings with American and European officials.
Members of U.S. Congress regularly meet MKO leaders where they offer any kind of support to the terrorist group. The U.S. is still supporting the terrorists in their anti-Iran campaigns. The MKO killed our top nuclear scientists, and that was not possible without the U.S. and Israel's assistance.
I lost my husband in the 1981 bombing of the Islamic Republic Central Office by the MKO. Interestingly, the spearhead of the terrorist operation, whose real name is Ali Mohtamed, took refuge in the Netherlands, and they welcomed him until a few years ago when the MKO disposed of him as a lost cause.
The American Human Rights Week started on June 27th, which marks the anniversary of the failed assassination of the then Iranian president Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei by the MKO terrorists in 1981, and will end on July the 3rd, which coincides with the anniversary of the U.S. Navy's shooting down of an Iranian passenger plane in 1988. Organizers of the occasion say the ultimate goal of the week-long ceremonies is to expose the U.S.'s double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Elsewhere, Syrian media say several rockets have been fired at a U.S. military base at the El Omar oil field located in the country's east. Reports say the attack caused damage to the base but no casualties. This comes less than 24 hours after the U.S. airstrikes targeted positions of Iraq's popular mobilization units on both sides of the Iraqi-Syrian border. Our correspondent in Syria has more updates.
Mortar shells were fired and they hit a U.S. Base in an area in the Al-Zour countryside in, of course, Al Omar oil field. The mortar shells hit and targeted a U.S. base over there. This is according to the state news agency over here in Syria. We still don't have any comments from the United States on this particular attack. In fact, this is one of the largest and most richest oil fields in Syria, Al Omar oil field, which is in Deir ez-Zor countryside. It is occupied by the United States. The United States occupies many parts of Syria in the north where it is a rich area of oil. It is giving all of that oil to the Kurdish side, so-called Syria's Democratic Forces, and also using some of that oil in order to finance its presence inside Syria and Iraq.
So the U.S. military has carried out fresh airstrikes on positions of Iraq's popular mobilization units. The Pentagon claims it hit militants involved in attacks on U.S. interests in Iraq, but the PMU has strongly rejected the allegation.
The Pentagon confirmed it carried out airstrikes on positions of Iraq's popular mobilization units on both sides of the country's border with Syria. The Pentagon claimed the Sunday night strikes were defensive and in retaliation for what it called the PMU's drone attacks on U.S. personnel and facilities in Iraq. But the PMU forces roundly rejected any involvement. They said they are part of Iraq's regular armed forces and that the soldiers who died in the U.S. raids were guarding the border. The PMU forces warned that they are ready to take revenge. The U.S. airstrikes are the second of their kind to be ordered by President Joe Biden against the PMU since he took office in January. Biden says the strikes are meant to end what he calls for forces attacks on U.S. interests, but Iraqis see things differently.
The Iraqi people, government officials, factions, and political figures see this attack as a boon to Daesh and other terrorists in Iraq and Syria. Through this attack, the U.S. seeks to weaken PMU forces in Iraqi and Syrian border areas so that Daesh terrorists can enter the Iraqi territory and carry out terrorist attacks. Effectively, the U.S. is now standing united with Daesh against the people of Iraq and its interests.
The strikes have been condemned across the political spectrum in Iraq. Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi denounced the airstrikes as a blatant and unacceptable violation of Iraq's sovereignty and its national security. The Iraqi military also issued a rare statement saying the U.S. move was a breach of the country's sovereignty. Different factions in the Iraqi parliament also condemned the airstrikes and called for steps to ensure such attacks will not repeat. They say the solution is ending the U.S. military presence in Iraq. That would be in line with a resolution adopted by the Iraqi parliament in January 2020, which called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. The Iraqi parliament passed a resolution days after the U.S. assassinated Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani, along with a deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes, in an airstrike near Baghdad airport. The U.S. has carried out more airstrikes on PMU positions ever since. During the period, Daesh terrorists have been the only other perpetrator of attacks on the popular forces.
And angry reactions are pouring in against the U.S. airstrikes. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah condemned the attack, saying such hostile actions make the Iraqi nation more determined to oust the occupiers from their country. It's added that the strikes against PMU positions are a clear violation of the sovereignty of both Iraq and Syria. Meanwhile, Yemen's Ansar Allah movement said the attack was in line with the U.S. aerial support for al-Qaeda and Daesh terror groups in the region. Ansar Allah also hailed the PMU for its resistance against what it called evil plots of Americans and Israelis. The Syrian government also slammed the U.S. airstrikes as, quote, a flagrant violation of the sanctity of Syrian and Iraqi lands. Ethiopia has declared a unilateral ceasefire in the Flashpoint Tigray region, signaling a turning point in the months-long conflict there. The truce comes after the former governing party there said it was back in control of the regional capital, Mekelle. In November, the central government launched an offensive to oust the Tigray's dissident regional leadership, promising a swift victory, but the ongoing conflict has triggered a humanitarian crisis, pushing some 350,000 people on the brink of famine. Both sides of the conflict have been accused of committing war crimes. Wraps up our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Missouri, where less than half of the population over the age of 18 has been fully inoculated, has emerged as the U.S. hotspot for the Delta strain, which officials say is fueling the alarming surge in coronavirus infections and hospitalizations that the state has experienced in recent weeks, even as cases decline in the U.S. as a whole. In this regard, we have prepared an article for Urian by Jake Johnson, reporter. This article is published under the heading, Dire Warnings as COVID Delta Variant Runs Rampant in Unvaccinated Missouri. Stay tuned for more. First detected in India and now present in at least 80 countries across the globe, the ultra-contagious Delta variant of COVID-19 is now running rampant through communities in the United States, with the most devastating impacts occurring in areas with low vaccination rates. Missouri, where less than half of the population over the age of 18 has been fully inoculated, has emerged as the U.S. hotspot for the Delta strain, which officials say is fueling the alarming surge in coronavirus infections and hospitalizations that the state has experienced in recent weeks, even as cases decline in the U.S. as a whole. Missouri currently has the highest rate of new COVID infections in the country. It's nearly 100% of the people hospitalized with COVID pneumonia are unvaccinated, said Dr. Robin Trotman, an infectious disease expert at Cox Health, a six-hospital nonprofit healthcare system headquartered in Springfield. Now, we do have vaccinated people who test positive, but they don't get severely ill. CNN reported recently that more than half of those admitted to the two major hospitals in the Springfield area are from surrounding counties with limited health clinics. Those counties each have fully vaccinated rates below 20%, the outlet noted. The national average is more than twice that figure at 46%. According to the Associated Press, the coronavirus surge in Missouri is happening largely in a politically conservative farming region in the northern part of the state and in southwestern corner, which includes Springfield and Branson, the county music mecca in Ozark Mountains, where big crowds are gathering again at the city's theaters and other attractions. While over 53% of all Americans have received at least one shot, most southern and northern Missouri counties are well short of 40%, AP observed. One county is at just 13%. Eric Frederick, Chief Administrative Officer at Mercy Hospital Springfield, told AP that 60% to 65% of patients in the ICU at his facility last weekend were under the age of 40, a segment of the population that is less likely to be vaccinated. In recent days, local public health officials and federal experts have been sounding the alarm about the threat posed by the Delta strain in the hope that residents of other states will learn from the public health disaster that's unfolding in Missouri. If people elsewhere in the country are looking to us and saying no thanks and they're getting vaccinated, that is good, said Frederick. We will be the canary. During a press briefing earlier this week, Dr. Anthony Fauci, head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, called the Delta variant the greatest threat in the U.S. to our attempt to eliminate COVID-19, unquote. Good news, vaccines are effective against the Delta variant, Fauci added. Conclusion, we have the tools, so let's use them and crush the outbreak. Missouri has seen the most acute consequences of the Delta variant thus far. The mutation is also spreading to Utah, New York, Nevada, Arkansas, and other states, raising concerns of an imminent nationwide spike in cases that could be followed by increased hospitalizations and deaths, particularly among the unvaccinated. An AP analysis recently found that nearly all COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. now are in people who weren't vaccinated. A staggering demonstration of how effective the shots have been and an indication that deaths per day now down to under 300 could be practically zero if everyone eligible got the vaccine. But the U.S. vaccination drive has slowed in recent weeks, and the Biden White House conceded that it will miss its goal of getting 70% of the nation's adults at least partially vaccinated by July 4th. Citing a new Centers for Disease Control and Prevention analysis released recently, the Washington Post reported that vaccine resistance is greater among younger people. Just 38.3% of those ages 18 to 29 have been vaccinated, the Post noted, adding, across all age groups, people living in counties with high rates of poor and uninsured people and less access to computers and the internet were less likely to be vaccinated. In general, rural and Republican areas have embraced vaccination less in cities and Democratic states in Northeast and along the West Coast. The Delta variant currently accounts for more than a third of all new coronavirus cases in the U.S. In India and the U.K., the strain is behind more than 90% of new infections. Officials in Sydney, Australia, are also rushing to contain Delta outbreak. After observing the startlingly swift rise of Delta variant in the U.K., other countries are bracing for the variant's impact if they aren't feeling it already. Nature's Ewan Calabay reported earlier this week. Nations with ample access to vaccines, such as those in Europe and North America, are hopeful that the shots can dampen the inevitable rise of Delta. But in countries without large vaccine stocks, particularly in Africa, some scientists worry that the variant could be devastating. Ashisha Jill, dean of the Brown University School of Public Health, warned in a series of tweets recently that the U.S. could soon see an infection surge similar to the one hitting the U.K., which has vaccinated a large percentage of its population. Adding, the U.K. experience suggests U.S. vaccination level will not be enough to ward off a Delta spike. The spike won't be uniform across the nation. Indeed, low-vax communities are particularly at risk.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Weir Points, and I'm Atar, the host of this program. We have two guest speakers in today's discussion, Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Mohsen Nahwi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
You're welcome, brother. And Brother Ali Alavian, assalamu alaikum to you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thank you for having me here.
So regarding the main features of the hegemonic powers in today's world and the challenges that they are facing, for today's discussion, we want to get a very important topic, which was also tackled by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, Supreme Leader of Iran, and that is the challenges that the hegemonic powers have regarding the Islamic values in today's world. The thing is that when you look at some of the Muslim lands, you find them as a caricature. For example, in terms of their food, they still use the same food as their forefathers did. But in terms of observing their hijab, they're very much similar to the Western world, in terms of their makeup too. So, and the sad news is that sometimes the value system, which is in the West, and it was abrogated, it was forbidden. So many laws and constitutions were written against them, are applied in the Muslim lands.
That's true.
For example, if a foreigner or if a people in the U.S. in a bar has going to one mini glass of wine, no, you can find it in the bars of some of the, unfortunately, Muslim lands. You know, a bottle of wine is going, bottle by bottle. Or, for example, if under 18 cannot watch this and that movie and the rating is over there, now it's this rating is going to be. I do want to say the value system has inserted into the culture. This is the sad news. And another sad news is that sometimes we forget completely that we can replace this value system with the good things that we have. But we take them for granted.
You know,
taking all of them for granted.
You know, the main issue is we forgot something.
Yeah.
Which is very important, that in this world, there is an evil and there is a good.
Mm-hmm.
God has set a path for us.
Yes.
And that which deviates us from that path is evil.
That's right.
It's not the discussion of West and the Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a discussion between like West and East, Muslim and non-Muslim. It's not about this.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about, are you being the true servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, mm-hmm, or the God or not?
That's right.
If you're following the evil, evil never wants you to have dignity, to have independence. It wants to make you the slave, either in the sense of, you know, either in the sense of, we can say, being under the slavery of capital system,
that's
capitalism.
Right. That's right.
Or the secular system.
Okay.
So all these things are being, brought by evil. And evil is doing its job the best way it can.
Recently, I saw some comments and some posts on the Instagram regarding LGBT, lesbian homosexualism. I said, wow, come on. This movement is banned in some of the Western countries.
Yes. Every single religion has banned it. Every single.
Yeah.
Christianity, Judaism, I don't know, Hinduism, everyone.
Okay.
Within this religious script, it is banned.
Yes.
But obviously, the evil is doing its job.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We forgot that the evil is our enemy, but evil never forgets.
That's all right.
Okay. So it's true that you said that there is no conflict between West and East, or let's say Islam and non-Islam.
No. Sayyid said that when you want to look at this value system, look at it as an evil good thing,
yeah,
not the Western Islam.
I do agree with that.
Okay.
I just wanted to actually explain for those who are listening to us. But since it has, the representatives of each has been seen, for example, in the West and the other side in the East, so it comes to the mind that, okay, this is a conflict between East and West. But the root is there.
Mm-hmm.
The root is really what you said. But since those who are actually defending any of these two opposing ideas,
yes,
are in this part and the other part,
yes,
of the world, so it says that, for example, that whatever. No, we do not mean that whoever is in the West,
that's
is bad,
right,
or whoever is in the East is good.
I purposely do that. I said, like, we forgot about this. Why? Because in the East, even we have evils.
Very true.
The Muslim countries, the leaders, they're silent on the issue of the Palestine, for example.
Yes.
They're silent on the issue of Afghanistan.
For
the reasons they have.
Sure.
Yes.
In the West, there are many people who raise their voice,
mm-hmm,
against the, you know, the oppression that has been done by Zionist regime
That's
or Israel
right.
on the Gaza
right.
Strip.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have seen, for example, in London, the 150,000 people came to the streets.
Very
yes.
true.
In the solidarity of the Quds or the Palestinian
but
people.
What about the Muslim lands?
Yeah. So, so we need
yeah,
to
really,
we need
it's
to,
it's a
we need
to
remind
to
ourselves.
Have
yes.
you ever seen such a thing, for example,
we
in a country like Saudi Arabia? Or,
no,
for example, in a country like
UAE, or Qatar.
But
or
unfortunately,
Bahrain.
They are going for normalization of their
that's
relationship.
That's it, brother. We need
with
to remember
yeah,
that this evil and the good, we have forgot this.
They normalize.
And you know, when we say Western Muslims, within Muslim lands, they think like, okay, we are Muslim, we are the right people, so nothing is wrong with us.
Uh-huh.
That's why they're not raising their voice.
Mm-hmm.
We need to differentiate. We need to remind ourselves that there was from the first day when Adam alayhi salam was created, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has ordered like the angels to do sajda to Adam, there was a discussion of an enemy of the Adam, and that was Shaitan, the evil. And it was the promise of Shaitan that I will, for example, like hijack all these you know, the values
That's
of the descendants of Adam alayhi salam.
Yes.
We need to remember this because, you know, when we go back to the origin of everything,
mm-hmm.
the things are very easy to explain.
Yes.
Yes.
But when we do not refer to the origin,
mm-hmm.
then obviously we can find many examples. You know, these are the examples. We say masadiq.
That's right.
We generally talk about the individuals,
yes.
examples, not the origin.
Very
so we need to refer to the origin, inshallah.
That's all right. But
yeah.
steadfastness of the Muslims are really important. You know, this mughavama and this resistance, you know, is very important. But unfortunately, we could see that. And, you know, again, when we get back down to this Saudi Arabia, you know, Ben Salman thing, the case is that the discourse has changed.
Mm.
You know, when Trump was in the power, so all of a sudden when Trump goes and another government in the U.S. comes, their discourse also changes
mm-hmm.
towards Iran, maybe towards the other lands. And this shows that how much puppets they are
mm.
to the politics and the policies of the U.S. and the superpowers.
Well, maybe it's because like Trump has milked all milk.
No, they have much milk, brother. There is still to milk them.
It's nothing
so
much
milk and milk. The black milk is oil. Yeah.
As I think the outcome of all this discussion is, and said referred to also, and I at the beginning of my discussion said, so the root all goes towards the good understanding of Islam, what
mm.
we call it pure Muhammadan Islam. And they are all the subcategories of
yes.
this discussion.
Yes.
So if they are the arrogant powers or let's say hegemonic powers, they are against it, they don't want us to go back to this understanding of Islam.
That's all right.
The outcome of which is unity, anti-arrogance, and let's say anti-Israel, and let's say intellectualism and rationalism in Islam
right.
world.
I don't know. In Afghanistan, for example, they are progressing the peace talks. You know, the peace talks are over there. The representatives are over there. The superpowers are over there. At the same time, we could see bomb explosion over there. This barbarism over there. You know.
Do you know what is the reason of this new bombing in Afghanistan and Iraq?
No.
This is the new strategy, brother. Look, when the other guy, when the other one left the White House, the next one wants to warn the countries that they said that we don't want U.S. to be there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They want to say these are the
reasons.
Outcomes.
Yeah.
These are the reasons that we need to be there,
mm-hmm.
and then. There is another thing, brother. This is for me, you, and other, all those who are listening to us. Whenever Israel, look, there is a key equation in the region. Whenever Israel is in danger, other nations should be in danger as well. Whenever there is a, let's say, conflict between Muqawma, resistance line, and Israel, other countries should be in instability. So these are the two reasons of these new and recent bombardings in Afghanistan or Iraq. And
right.
we have
That's
to be waiting for.
Yes, we can just add in, like, whenever the Israel is in danger, obviously, why they do bombings in other countries is so that the people in those countries, the Muslim lands,
mm-hmm.
basically, it's not happening in non-Muslim lands.
Mm-hmm.
It's happening in the Muslim lands. Why it happens? So that these Muslim people do not raise their voice.
Right.
So they cannot
not come
to
the awareness
yes.
level.
Yes, and they should they stop them by bombing the Muslim lands so that the people from these lands do not come to the help the Gaza Strips or you know the Palestinians.
Right.
So there are many reasons, obviously,
yeah.
and these are clear. Those who have a little bit of intellect, inshallah, everyone possess the intellect,
yeah.
they can understand.
Yeah.
All these things. If I can just give you an example of how you know
yes.
the West creates, you know, wrong kind of you know
attitudes,
yes. or you know the wrong thinkings, like how
yes.
it ejects into the minds. For example, you know, in West, there is a talk about the equality, the female and male equality,
mm-hmm.
and they said that the women do not have their right.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about male. The world is, you know, male prominent. That's how they say.
Yes, they say.
It's a male prominent.
Yes.
Mm.
But they never look at, like, in the wars, there were the men who are killed. You know, on the streets, it's the men who are the most
yes.
victims. You know, in the jobless or homeless people, it's more men. So, you know, there are different ways
but
of
the same voice that says such a thing. They are totally silent when women and
yeah.
And when women and
children
and infants in Israel are being killed.
Yes,
day by day, and no
in
one
Palestine,
is saying
yeah.
anything. So aren't they women? Don't they have the rights? So
unfortunately, you know, this male orientation towards running the country, much male. I mean, not looking for the just attitude, as in Islam says, leading to such movement like feminism. An extremist feminism, okay, that brings us up, okay, why the women should be pregnant, men can be pregnant too. See? They are talking.
This is not in his capacity.
This is not in his capacity. But I do want to say, no, we could see such slogans nowadays, brother. Right,
if
yeah. among
can,
the feminists.
If they want male to become pregnant,
yeah,
can female
do
something that the male
yeah, can. I don't know.
This is Islam when, again, invites us towards rationalism. And
yeah, we have
this
to.
Islamic
yes.
intellectualism.
Getting
is
back to origin, what Sayyid said, getting back to the origin. And poor earth, how much capacity this earth has to behold all these phenomena, all these disasters from day one until now. And it's still working for us, man. It's still running, still rotating, still having energy, having rain for us, you know, everything. Resources, tabia is over there. How much poor earth is, brother, tolerating all these phenomena in today's world? And I think that one day we have to do our right of just and justice to ourselves, toward the earth we are living.
You know,
you
pointed a very good point. For example, you know, if chickens stop giving eggs.
Yeah.
You know, what's going to happen?
If the cows
if they protest, like the cock should obviously give the eggs and we should rest.
Yes.
You know, there is a nature.
Yeah, yeah,
there is a nature.
Brother.
You cannot change it. The world is doing its job.
Yeah.
The trees are giving fruits.
Yes.
The water is there. It's because of us humans that we have the shortage of water.
And how much
the environmental
justice,
change.
Yeah.
And we are doing injustice towards this nature as well.
Yes.
We are oppressing this nature because of our, you know, inventions and the things that we have. So
nature,
we need to
animal, you know, if there was going to be a big rally and demonstration of justice, be sure that it would be first the tabia, the trees and the sheep and the animals.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we have to answer that, brother, in the other words. Okay. That's all right. Nice discussion, nice fruitful discussion regarding what are the Islamic exact values of the Islamic system, how to revive them, and why the Western and hegemonic powers are opposing and confronting this value system. I hope that all the Muslim lands get back to the pure Muhammadan Islam, practice the pure Islamic values, and we get back to our pure original nature and fitrah, innate nature, inshallah, one day. It was very kind of you, Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Brother Ali Alavian. Nice, fruitful discussion. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to this episode of Viewpoints, a discussion on the views and lectures of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. It was very kind of you, dear listeners. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. This series are produced by Brother Mahmoud. please bring your comments and ideas. We can say on our email address, coi@irib.ir. Also, you can visit our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Do not forget to visit our website, parstoday.com/Ian, Call of Islam page. In another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanillah.
So far from you, yet to me you were always so close. I wandered lost in the dark. I closed my eyes to all the signs you put in my way. I walked every day further and further away from you. Ooh, Allah, you brought me home. I thank every breath I take.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
In the limelight.
Research shows that a previous coronavirus infection plus one dose of vaccine provides powerful protection, but concerns linger, says Ely Dalgin, author, in an article titled, "Is one vaccine dose enough if you've had COVID? What science says?" Stay tuned for more. People who have been infected with the coronavirus might be able to safely skip the second jab of any two-dose vaccine regimen, a growing number of studies suggest. These results could help to stretch scarce vaccine supplies and are already influencing vaccination policies in some countries. But questions remain about whether the findings hold for all individuals and all vaccines, and therefore how policymakers should respond to the findings. Studies show that people with previous exposure to SARS-CoV-2 tend to mount powerful immune responses to single shots and gain little added benefit from another injections. What's more, for people with immunity gained through infection, one dose typically boosts antibody numbers to levels that are equal to or often greater than those found individuals who have not been infected and have received double doses. Scientists who have studied immune responses to vaccinations say such policies are a sensible way to make the most of limited supplies in countries that are racing to inoculate their populations. To follow the current two-dose vaccination schedule in previously infected individuals when there are millions of people waiting for their first dose simply does not make sense, says Jordi Ocando, an immunologist at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City, who has advised the Spanish government on vaccination guidelines. But scientists still don't know whether one jab program for the previously infected could leave some individuals with suboptimal protection. Nor is it clear that such programs would be effective for all types of vaccine. If you have been infected before, then probably one dose is sufficient, says Giuliana Magri, an immunologist at the Hospital del Mar Research Institute in Barcelona, Spain. But putting that knowledge into practice, it's complicated, she concludes. There is ample lab-based evidence that people who have been infected by SARS-CoV-2 benefit from vaccination, prompting the World Health Organization and other public health agencies to recommend that such individuals still get vaccinated. There is less clarity, however, on whether they need to roll up their sleeves twice. A paper published in Nature on June 14th provides some of the most recent evidence that one shot could be all that's necessary for people who have had COVID-195. A team of researchers at the Rockefeller University in New York City and elsewhere studied 26 people who had contracted the virus early in the course of the pandemic. All of them subsequently received at least one dose of either vaccine based on messenger RNA. The researchers analyzed participants' level of neutralizing antibodies, potent immune molecules that can block the virus from entering cells. At the moment, the quantity and vigor of a person's neutralizing antibodies are the best markers for assessing whether that person is protected from infection and illness, although scientists are still working to confirm that antibody levels can serve as a realistic stand-in for immune protection. The team also assessed participants' level of memory B cells, which remember pathogens and can quickly crank out targeted antibodies if they encounter an infectious agent that they have seen before. Within a month or two of vaccination, study participants' levels of memory B cells had risen on average nearly tenfold, and their titers, or levels of neutralizing antibodies, had shot up around 50-fold. Those gains were apparent in previously infected participants, whether they had received one shot or two. In fact, just one dose of vaccine generated titers equal to or higher than those produced by two doses of vaccine in people without previous infections. It's really amazing, says virologist Theodora Hatzimano, who co-led the study. I wish everyone's titers were like this. Findings from Theodora and her colleagues also hint at the biological underpinnings of one jab's effectiveness in exposed people. In the 12 months after participants were infected, their memory B cells had not been static. Instead, those cells spent the entire year evolving, which left them able to craft antibodies even more potent and versatile than those they produced immediately after the infection. Other studies corroborate that thinking, with some showing that one shot can spare the growth of antibodies and infection-fighting T cells alike. We are all seeing pretty much the same thing, says John Wary, an immunologist at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine in Philadelphia. For people who have recovered from COVID-19, the second shot doesn't seem to do a whole lot. One jab policy for those who have been infected might even help to overcome vaccine apathy, says Stacy Wood of North Carolina State University in Raleigh, a marketing expert who has studied vaccine messaging. She argues that rather than sowing confusion, outreach that amounts for individual characteristics can help convince people who feel that their own circumstances, including infection history, make them unique. Cutting down the number of shots and all the attendant side effects, anxiety, and time involved can also be an attractive proposition to some who are on the fence about getting immunized. The more tailored approach is probably better at this point, Wood says. The accumulating evidence has been enough to convince many scientists that second doses of precious vaccine should not be allotted to people who have been infected. Providing only one dose to those who have had COVID-19 would free up many urgently needed vaccine doses. Scientists also point out that some people who become infected with SARS-CoV-2 mount a relatively weak immune response. Such a response is especially common in people who don't develop COVID-19 symptoms. There is a huge range of antibody generation and durability in those individuals, notes Wary. Making decisions based on previous PCR-confirmed infections might miss some people. That's where diagnostic antibody testing could help. Screenings for antibodies to the hepatitis B virus is already routine in some settings to guide vaccination strategies against that infectious agent, and the same could be done with antibodies to the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, a marker of both natural and vaccine-induced immunity, says Viviana Simon, an infectious disease specialist at Mount Sinai and a signatory to the e-biomedicine letter. When in doubt, I'm all for a second dose, she says. But I personally hope that we can move eventually to more personalized schedules and recommendations.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.